Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to a Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
I'm Ron Green. I'm a professor of communication studies at the University of Minnesota.
And Ron, we've been friends for, I think, 25 years,
That's about
probably.
right.
But I don't think, I mean, I think we've been friends since before there was a thing called the National Communication Association in the US. When it was called the Speech Communication Association.
That's
And I didn't
correct.
even know what that was until I was lucky enough to meet you, and you and others educated me, but especially you. And so it's a great privilege to be with you today because it really is a long time since we've chatted, but it doesn't feel like a long time.
Yes, correct.
It's great to be together.
No,
And
it's great to be here.
as you know, I like to start with this very general, but at the same time, quite personal question, which is to ask of you what is preoccupying, worrying, dynamizing, interesting you these days?
Right. Thank you. I am returning to some research that me and my writing partner Darren Hicks had begun at
Lovely, Darren. Yeah.
the turn of the century around the problem of conviction. And this has been particularly animated, perhaps because of the shift since perhaps 2008, but definitely through the pandemic and through the Trump presidency, around the particular politics of conviction. And what I kind of mean there, I think what we mean there is a particular relationship between what we identified a number of years ago as people's first order convictions. What is it that people believe and willing to argue for and to perhaps, hit the streets for or to fight for in some particular way? And its relationship with a second order conviction, which often had to do with processes of interaction or processes of argumentation that seemed to need to be in place for the first order convictions to have space to interact with other first order convictions. And so we dubbed this back in the day the moral economy of conviction, and we studied it from the context of of pedagogical interventions surrounding how to train students in debate and in argumentation to sort of learn how to invest in debate as a process and not to treat debate simply as a place to express your first order conviction. And to try to win the debate always required one's commitment to the process of debate as something that was important, either politically or epistemologically or socially or some sort of dynamic. For us, what we discovered was that the second order conviction wasn't an empty process, but in fact was given given an ethical substance. And in the case of the Cold War, it was given the ethical substance of free and full expression. So it allowed for debate then to be given this, your true commitment to debate wasn't that we're just going to make you good advocates arguing for your convictions, but we were going to construct in you an encounter with the second order conviction first, such that you would be fully committed to debate as a process or a method of democracy. And to be able to think about who, we might come back to this, but how that functions as a way to include and exclude people, or to identify good citizens versus bad citizens, being those citizens who are willing to commit to the second order versus those citizens who are not. Forgive that long introduction, but it was but the reason why this has become increasingly more important, I think, is While we think most deliberative democratic theories have, in their terms, a sort of, they might call it a thin commitment to a process, but that is, it doesn't require, they don't think it requires a lot, except some sort of general commitment to liberal political culture. That's how Habermas recently just described it, right? That nonetheless, we think this moral economy is in fact breaking down. And it perhaps has been breaking down for a good 30 or 40 years, but it's been breaking down on the left and on the right. It's breaking down on the right through sort of new Trumpian, well, let's call it right-wing populisms, and they're not just in the United States, they're in lots of different particular parts of the world. And they've been critiqued from the left, certain kind of deep structural critiques of, liberalism as, disguising particular kind of exclusions, refusing some refusing to recognize how inviting people into dialogue, deliberation, and debate seems to require that some give up their critiques of the violence of, say, settler colonialism, for example. And so if the left and the right seem to be in agreement that this moral economy is a problem, right? We're trying to rethink it, right? And trying to think, is there a
Yes,
new way to
yes.
think the moral economy, or is there or are we just living in one of those stages of world history in which it is a democratic antagonism, left, right, and other, and it's going to play itself out, right, around the question, which side are you on, right? And that there isn't a mediator or a mechanism of the second order
Understood.
to.
Now, Ron, I've got two responses to that. And remember, I'm not an expert in these matters, as are you and Darren. By the way, I'm very keen to get Darren on the podcast. I was looking for an address for him the other day and couldn't find it. So perhaps you can connect us.
I
In
will.
fact, perhaps we could organize a roundtable with you and Darren and someone else to talk about some of these things for the podcast.
That'd be great.
So I guess I've got two responses to this. One is, I've recently been teaching Chantal Mouffe's work to students here in Spain, and she speaks very good Spanish. She actually taught in Colombia in the 70s. And as you know, she has a critique of Habermas and the idea of consensus based on a notion of agonistic relations, but agonistic relations that can fit your second order notion
That's
of commitment or conviction or disputation, right?
right.
You don't have to do this to destroy the other person. You don't have to deny their right to a point of view, but nor are you obliged to say, well, inevitably at the end of our chat, we'll come to the right position, which is something akin to the Habermasian perspective of the Ideal Speech Act. So that's my first response to what you said, and I'd love to hear what you think of that. My second response is to say that, and although the plurality of listeners to the podcast is based in the US, the majority isn't. And some of this relates to a notion of what is rhetoric, what is debating, what is forensics that is unique to the United States in some ways. And as I say, it's one of the things that you taught me when we first met. So I'm wondering if, after responding perhaps to what I said about MOOF, if you think it's of interest, you might also give us a brief Cook's tour, an adumbration. If this is Tuesday, this must be Belgium 60s movie title of the whole question of debate as it stands in the US, because it's an area where you and Darren, individually and together, have made massive contributions for decades.
So exactly the Mufian problem, if you will, is what is animating Darren and I a bit on why we think this is a real problem right now, which is to take the distinction about the friend and the enemy that is in Mouffe as well. And when you have antagonisms without agonisms, right, you almost are, and from her perspective, you're almost always led to a friend-enemy binary that is leads to lots of bad things. I mean, I don't want to overplay it in certain contexts, but it leads to death in some particular forms, right? But an absolute exclusion, right? That your enemy has to be absolutely excluded, versus the idea of agonism, which is partly associated with, if you will, an opposition, right? And an opposition, whether it be the loyal opposition, as one rhetoric might put it, is allows for that space for something like a second order economy of interaction. We're calling it conviction, right? But a second order conviction in the processes of democratic debate, discussion, dialogue, persuasion, as a particular opportunity for thinking through democratic associational life, right? And particularly, and you get more complex societies, right? Or complicated social situations, right? And by that, I just mean to say, living within a polity that is going to accept some notion of pluralism, right? That's gonna, there will be different religions, different, right, senses of the good life, and people can pursue those within, particular bounds of agreements that these are appropriate, right? And so that's exactly right. I mean, I think Mouffe has said, now, to be fair to Habermas, I mean, he seems to these days be much more willing to immediately say he thinks it's all agonal too. He thinks the public sphere is all agonal. He never meant to imply, I mean, I think the quote in 2022 is, "I never meant to imply this to be all a convivial university seminar," I think is how he puts it. The public sphere is always going to be agonal. But he wants that commitment to a liberal political culture. And I mean, he's blaming most of what's happening now on, or at least one cause, or he's calling it the new structural transformation, or others are calling it the new structural transformation of the public sphere, which is what's been happening with social media and particularly platformization, and how that's sort of leading to a kind of media ecology that's not great. But to your point, I think Mouffe sets up the problem, right? And others, I mean, it's a, Tony Negri's passed away recently, so I've been thinking a lot about Tony. But I mean, if you go back to 2000 with Hart and the book Through Empire, at least the first volume, it kind of changes as we make our way through the trilogy. But the seeming emphasis there at a particular moment in time of market sovereignty, in which they are arguing, or one way to read it is they're arguing against most mediations, and kind of arguing that, hey, we are in the moment of the antagonism, and there doesn't seem to be a place for him, or at least it didn't always seem to be visible to me at the time, and that's why I'm starting to rethink and reread. Is, whether or not there was an opportunity there, except are you on the side of the multitude? And even if we're on the side of the multitude, as others started arguing, as we've seen, it can go in a lot of different directions, right? The multitude has, right? I mean, we could say whichever way the multitude goes is democracy, but I think at least some of us still have a normative conception of democracy that we don't want to quite give up quite yet, right? However that's going to look, right? But I think that's what we're in a moment of reinvention of those, or I think the left needs to reinvent and needs to be reinventing fast, right? Because the right seems to have some ideas about where they want to go.
I think that's true, and I think the other thing that's changed is that The politics of spectacle and song and performance, which used to be thought of as the domain of a resistive left, has been captured by the right, such that the critics of cultural studies from the left and a spectacularization of politics from the left almost seem vindicated. But anyway, we can get back to that if you want. What about this issue of the nature of the study of debate and the training in debate in the United States? Because I think this is terrifically important, both in terms of Americanization during the Reform era, but also in terms of all those good old boy, good old girl notions of a town hall and we can all get on together and people will chat in a folksy way that seem ludicrous to many people elsewhere, but form an important part of the US political process as well as ideology, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I should say, as we get back to this, I mean, I think it's why so many of the US political debate, even right now, is going through the category of free speech, right? That's so much if you're here, I mean, so one of the things that's going on is the ways in which campus speech issues have returned because of the crisis in Gaza, right? And changes in student activist relationships to the Palestinian cause, as well as concerns of Jewish students about the ways in which, you know, from their perspective, things will bleed into anti-Semitism. And I bring that up as if you read the legacy press, right? It's still this question of, well, you know, what's happened to free speech on American campuses? And this has been kind of going on since the hate speech debates of the 90s, but this is just one place, right? And it also appears on social media, right? I mean, people like corporate censorship of, you know, deplatforming the right on certain social medias has led to the right passing laws, which are the Supreme Court is recently, U.S. Supreme Court is recently talking about, over whether or not you could have state laws that ban social media from deplatforming conservatives, right? Or particularly anybody, but in these cases, it's particularly worried about conservatives. So there's something kind of about. Maybe because the U.S. First Amendment, right, is the freedom of speech in our Constitution. There's something about, I would argue, there's something about communication and particularly how it intersects free speech that is a primary, at least since the 20th century, is a primary configuration of political citizenship in the United States, right? In fact, I mean, in other places, I've gone so far as to say that the concept of communication does work in the United States the way in which the concept of culture often does work in places like Europe in terms of governmental policies and governmental relations, right? Or like what, as you know, and you taught me about cultural policy studies, and in some ways in the US, that really goes through a lot of it goes through communication policy, right? And how we do communication policy. So all that just to come back to say, within that structure of, you know, progressive, and by this I mean like John Dewey, American social liberalism, right? That discussion, debate, persuasion are the constitutive features of citizenship and the constitutive features of a kind of American exceptionalism that, you know, that often gets expressed as a form of American exceptionalism. But this has a long history with this dis that with communication studies in the United States, which has a peculiar history, as we were referencing in the beginning, around this idea of the National Society for the Teachers of Speech, These were often at the early part of the 20th century. These were teachers of public speaking. They might have been aligned with people who were theater teachers, anybody that kind of did sort of platform speaking, whether that platform was a real platform, like a stage, right? Anytime people are up on a stage, right? And that sort of constituted this discipline called speech. But one of the things that was inside this discipline of speech at the time was in a full-on investment in debate and debate training as a mechanism of emerging professional middle-class citizenship training. And before the mass expansion of higher education in the United States after World War II, I mean, throughout the 20s and 30s, this was a core element of American sort of conceptualization of what a speech department was doing. So even if you read like 1948 books on, I teach this in my history with rhetoric class, I mean, these 1948 books on teaching people how to be critics of public speech or oratory, there's still this discussion of, well, we make you critics and advocates at the same time, right? And so A. Craig Baird, for example, who's writing along with Lester Thompson, one of the first big sort of welcome to our new discipline of speech criticism, right? We're going to criticize oratory more than we're just going to train people to be advocates. But A. Craig Baird was also the debate coach at Iowa, right? And so you still have this sort of intersection between to create an advocate and to create a critic are some of the same skills of being able to analyze talk in a particular way so that you could produce reasonable, right? Reasonable citizens, right? So that's a short answer. And then debate has its own histories, its ups and downs, its particular activity. You will occasionally see the Brookings Institution in the United States, or you'll see other think tanks every once in a while say, hey, what's wrong or what's right with high school education or middle school education? And sometimes they'll say, well, debate education is a way to go to solve a problem, right? Because you're committing people a commitment to good evidence and sound reasoning and good advocacy skills. And, it's always an image of the citizen, right? This active citizen in a complex world in which, those spaces of activity seem to not be available to everyone. I have a hard time convincing my undergraduates that these spaces exist for them, right? That for them to use these advocacy skills beyond them immediately switching to professional life, right? And going quickly, well, Mark, I'm going to be a social media manager or something like that, right? Which is all cool, right? But this sort of vision of a citizen as an advocate, right? And that you would be advocating at your PTA and advocating at your town hall or going to your school boards or going to your just what it means to be an active person in your community, right? Means that you will need these skills of debate, discussion, and persuasion. Are it's deep in the bones of communication in speech communication in the United States, right? Now lots of things have changed. There was a time where it would have been hard to throw a stick at the NC at the National Communication Association and not hit an old debater or not hit an old debate coach. Right. My first job after my MA degree was I was the director of debate at Middle Tennessee State University. I partly went to Illinois to get out of to transition out of the activity because they didn't have a big time college debate program. And so I was trying to move a bit away. And there have been for your folks who know, I mean, beyond the US context, the what is often referred to as is a world format, which is often something built more on a parliamentary debate model, where you have a house and different sides of the house, and you try to organize debates around that, which I've discovered as I'm working with more international students, that that's their experience with debate is a sort of world's format, which is exploding in the United States as well. And it is partly, I mentioned that to only say that there are different national histories, international histories of debate that have also started to inform the United States. And so what used to be a very clubby world of we all did the same kind of debate, right, started to fall apart probably as early as the 70s, but I saw it fall apart in the 90s, and then it kind of be brought back together again, and then it fragmented it again into a whole bunch of different formats of debate. So there's lots of different formats with all different rules,
Yeah.
regulations,
So
and
some of this is about lowercase Republican virtues and the idea of the engaged citizen and a government of laws rather than oligarchies, but also one of discussion.
yes,
Some of this
absolutely.
is to do with college sports and the oral version of those, yeah,
That's
per
right.
being a debate coach
That's
and
right.
go school. And some of this, presumably, correct me if I'm wrong, connects to the Americanization efforts of that period of mass migration from Eastern, Central, and Western Europe to the Americas, especially the US and Argentina, between about 1880 and 1920, 30,
That's right.
when people would arrive, say, in the Midwest and couldn't speak English, looked for a Lutheran church because they were Swedish, say. So that meant they could find people who spoke Swedish, which meant they could find people who could help them get a job, all the rest of it. But there was a need for skilled proletarian labor in industrial manufacturing contexts and agricultural contexts where people could communicate, could read and write English and speak English. There's an element of that to the debate norm, isn't there?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would put that, yeah, I mean, even when my own sort of relationship to communication wasn't going through debate, you will see all of that, right? You will see the professionalization of speech education back in the day included language. I mean, welcome to English, right? And foreign language education. And my colleague Zornica Kermanicheva has been doing work on the early part of the 20th century, and particularly the role of other social education institutions like the YMCA and the YWCA dealing with these particular populations, and teaching the coming new proletariat, the Fordist worker, if you will, to learn enough English to be able to work the lines, to be able to interact in such a way that to increase safety and any number of things. And I've been doing some of that work on the Y as well in terms of the role of their film bureau back in the day.
Yes.
But you would also find it, I mean, as we might say, Americanization. Or we might say, or Foucault might say, right? Americanization as a discourse statement, right, will proliferate between this period of the 1880s to the 1920s, but particularly, right, in the United States, as it's intersecting the professionalization, new professionalizations of higher education were changing, right? Actual old rhetoric departments become English departments that become. Get split off into speech and English departments, right? The national language, right, is happening as others have narrated those stories more perhaps in England and in the US, but that process of Americanization and what that meant in terms of the intersection with Fordism and the coming of a new skilled proletariat are intersecting absolutely throughout this period. And it's affecting communication, or at the time we were known as a speech department, but it's affecting higher education as well, right? And I think I was at Illinois, and I think I looked up on the sign, and it was like, you know, and this is before the mass, you know, democratization of higher ed, of course. But, you know, you walk around the University of Illinois and you see things emblazoned on the building, learning and labor, right? And so it's fully understood that this learning at the time was also part of transforming a labor force, even if at the time we're talking slightly at universities might have been a slightly more elevated proletariat than, or the new coming professional middle class is probably more to the point.
And so it has a cross-class significance, though, in different ways.
Yeah.
This also relates to part of the work in your pathbreaking book, Malthusian Worlds, a wonderful book, which takes us into the 1990s, but begins a century before.
Right.
And so much of the history of debate in the US, it seems to me, again, as a rank outsider, is to do with population, with managing populations. And sometimes that's about fertility, and sometimes it's about language, and sometimes it's about lots of different things. Could you take, if you could still remember Malthusian Worlds, because it is 25 years since it came out, could you take us back, as they say in baseball parlance, to the influence, or first of all, perhaps explain a bit about Thomas Malthus, but also his influence in the US and how this relates both to this era of reform that we're discussing, but also much later.
Yeah, you'll forgive the plug. I've been working with a translator in Iran right now, who ran into Malthusian Worlds and is working on a translation into Farsi. And so I have written an interesting, I tried to do a new preface to the book. And so I'm fingers are crossed, given other context, that this makes its way. And just as a slight, this book is available online. Just Google me if you find it interesting. It occasionally gets picked up in a journal like Economy and Society every once in a while. But I say that only because Routledge bought Westview, and or whoever owned, or Taylor and Francis, I guess, right, bought Westview, which is where my book was originally published. After I got back the copyright from Westview. And then Routledge made the book available through a digital version without working out copyright with me. So do not go buy this book from Routledge if for some reason they're offering you a version. I can give it to you for free, and it's up. You can find it if you'd like to use it. So Routledge wouldn't work out with me, though a new relationship about copyright. But the Iranians who don't have the Berne Convention were willing to work with me. So anyways, strange worlds.
Malthusian worlds.
Malthusian worlds, yes. And I only bring that up to say that the current problem seems to be, increasingly people are more worried about depopulation in particular parts of the world now, compared to a particular time that I'm going to take us back to, which was a peculiar time in which people were worried about overpopulation. And so absolutely the link is there. I mean, if I had to, I mean, I'm always honest about this. I mean, if I had to, I met you before I met you. I was reading versions of Well-Tempered Self before it was Well-Tempered Self, right? And because I think you were sharing it with Larry is kind of how I got.
Well, Larry Grossberg was one of the people who graded my PhD, so that's probably.
Maybe that's why, because he said, "I think you're going to like this, so read it, right, or start reading it." The point of this is that what was holding me together through all of this work was a certain interest in governmentality and governance and population regulation, if you will, right? So whether I'm talking about debate or I was talking about Malthus at that particular time, I mean, I was thinking through these different scales of governance that are happening that relate to the United States, but not trying to localize it in the United States. So obviously Malthus, you know, has its history in England and or in Great Britain, and part of it is a very simple argument that that's more complex than this, but a simple argument that population growth will happen faster than food production. And part of what radically made Malthus interesting for modernity was that the healthy body, in other words, the reproducing body, was not seen as a sign of a good social body, right? In other words, the reproducing body can be a threat to the social body, right? And this, of course, particularly becomes associated with particular kind of populations threaten the social body, right? The poor, right? The reserve armies of England at the particular time, right? The reserve armies of labor, right? And the particular need to think Malthus outside of that context. In other words, I didn't want to do a reading of Malthus as much as I wanted to see how Malthus was taken up, right? Yes. With a recognition that it was never just everybody's not everybody's reproductive processes, but it often tended to be an isolation to certain populations were associated with the Malthusian couple, again, to steal Foucauldian term from the first volume of Sexuality, right? And so I was interested in how this traveled to the United States because I knew a lot about this debate, if you will, in the 70s, because when I was coming through my own relationship to high school and college debate, right, in the aftermath of Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, the coming of a modern environmental movement, the relationship between a modern environmental movement and global notions of environmental harm and the limits to growth. And a lot of that had to be, it was intersecting concerns about population growth in particular parts of the world as well, right? And I'll come back to that maybe, because I actually, one of the things that I tried to argue is that one of the things that was really important about understanding the late 60s was the way in which population reproductive dynamics got placed back on the white middle class, right? That the whole sort of notion of cultural distinction gets attached to one's control of their reproduction, right? Uh-huh. And maybe we'll come back to that. But the point to go back to the right, when the American narrative of the Turner thesis, right, the frontier is closed, right? As soon as the frontier is closed, which again, we're talking about the early part of the 20th century, we're talking about all these new migrants into the United States, diasporic populations into the United States. This is about the moment that Malthus arrives in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As soon as you start thinking that there's something like a closed limit to the potential of America, Malthus had its way of finding a home, right? And you can even find this home in a lot of early 20th century birth control advocates. You can find this sort of theme popping up in the professionalization of the coming of American demography as a particular kind of sub variation of sociology and the Population Association of America. And so it started to have its home, the coming of a new environmental movement even before the 60s, right, is starting
and
to happen.
Eugenics.
Yes,
It's
eugenics.
Teddy Roosevelt, eugenics and imperialism. Now that
That's
the frontier's been ended, and of course, very little thought about what that meant for Native American people, Native Mexicans, and so on, but on into these other really complicated values and norms, many of which we must view differently today, both because of First Peoples issues and because of the Holocaust, but which seemed quite logically intertwined at the time for white America and for much of the left, not
That's
just
right.
in the United States, but elsewhere, in terms of not just birth control, but a notion of purity as
That's
well.
right. That's right. That's right.
Immensely complicated to. It's like, Ron, when you read Kant or you read Dorothy L. Sayers, and much of the time you're just in there and it makes sense and you get it. And then Dorothy L. Sayers will say something about Jewish folks, or Kant will say something about women, and you realize I'm not there. Up to this point, this is all within me and I get it and it's all fine. And now I realize we're from different planets. And I think that's one of the things about these the Malthusian worlds that you achieve so wonderfully in the book. You manage to be critical at the same time as trying to understand these things in their philosophical and historical contexts.
Right. Right. Because, I mean, and partly through perhaps the way in which some of Stuart's work came to the United States, I mean, through Larry and others, right? I mean, around this idea of articulation, right? And I know that sometimes a term like that can, or concept, right, can lose its edge, right? Because everybody says everything's entangled now, or everybody says everything's articulated, or everyone says, but that was an important concept, right? It still is for me, because left, right, center, local character does in fact create alliances, to steal a Gramscian term. It creates alliances that you may not see at the time. One of the advantages, I guess, I get as a bit of an historian, I'm maybe a little better understanding how these alliances are forming in other times than I sometimes in my own time. But that is particularly important, because exactly what you're saying. I mean, what I wanted to do ultimately was to understand how U.S. leadership around this issue became a global, it's a geopolitical discourse,
Yes,
right, after
yes.
World War II in particular. And I was trying to understand, well, but that isn't happening just, it's not just like the United States is leading in the sense of trying to control the world in through this discourse, but it's being moved as well. It's being affected by these discourses. It's thinking about these discourses again when it thinks through its expansion of the welfare programs. When it starts dismantling welfare programs in the 90s, you start seeing these languages, U.S.
When you were doing this research, Ron, apologies for interrupting, this was the high point of the discourse of the racialized welfare queen who
That's
was
right.
black and getting pregnant all the time because of supposed factor endowments granted by the state. I mean, it was
That's right.
a horrifying moment in the United States. If
That's right.
it's possible to imagine a worse time than now, I think that was worse, actually.
It kind of had that sort of ending welfare as we know it, kind of progressive neoliberalism, feel to it, right?
Yeah,
It's like,
when
well, yeah, you got
Clinton,
to change something, but there was deep Malthusian, racialized Malthusian logics working throughout all of this, right? And that's kind of what I was trying to recognize, and to recognize how this was working, not just locally but globally, if you will. Or you could
Sure.
leap from urban centers in the United States. There were things that were linking things in the urban part of the United States through the UN to Calcutta, to all kinds of different vectors, if you will, of trying to reorganize our sense of space and worldly space around and local spaces around this problem of reproduction again, right? And it's kind of being reversed now. It's increasingly being done around depopulation, but the you know, part of what I was trying to do was kind of get to these, recognizing all the politics and exactly what you're saying, and trying to be honest and say, look, understand these racialized politics. They are here. They're working this way toward Black folks, but they might be working this way for white folks, and particularly a white middle class folks in this way. It might be how they're defining their whiteness is their ability to, you know, to be quote unquote responsible parents. And that is to control their reproduction in some particular, even if the, you know, some of the statistics of the differences were very small at particular moments in time, right? To recognize that these layers of governance, if you will, right, are crisscrossing in lots of different ways. And that's what I was trying to get at, is sort of how these discourses can attach themselves to different governing levers, right, or actors in particular ways, and then create kind of weird combinations that might be going on, I'll say it, but behind our back, even if I was trying to say it's all there to see if you do the work. But by the way, I just had to spend 2 years trying to figure that out. So yeah, there's a lot of work to figure that out, right? Well,
Prof. Ron, I've got a couple more questions for you, after which I'd like you to add anything that you wish. My first question is a bit personal. I hope you don't mind, as an old friend.
No, it's okay.
You're a son of the South.
Yeah.
And you've moved to other parts of the U.S. You're currently in the upper Midwest, which is contested territory, as all of the United States is, but has an important socialist agrarian history and a liberal history, Hubert Humphrey. What's it like for you as somebody who, when you open your mouth, will be stereotyped automatically in the rest of the US as a Southerner? And parenthetically, if I can throw in something here, Horace Newcomb once told me that he was from Mississippi.
Right.
And I said, gosh, I had no idea. I think of you as always being in Baltimore or Austin or in Georgia. And he said, oh, you know, when I was 21, I moved to Chicago to Wayne C. Booth's ethical criticism seminar in the PhD program, and no one would treat what I said seriously, so I changed my voice.
Right. Well, we'll have to decide whether your listeners think that my Southern accent is coming through. Usually it takes a beer or so to fully manifest. My mom was from the South, but I always tell people, first and foremost, I was a military brat, right? My parents were both in the military first. And my mom was obviously from the South first. And then she joined the military, and then she met my dad in the military. And this was a particular time when women got pregnant, they had to leave the military. And so she left the military, but my dad stayed in for a good 20 years. Now, part of that is I did most of my growing up, though, in the South. But in the beginning, it was beach communities. After a little short amount of time in New London, Connecticut, where I was born, I spent most of my time in either Charleston, South Carolina. Think submarine bases, East Coast, right? Oh. That's where it is, right? So Norfolk, Virginia, Virginia Beach, Virginia, Key West, Florida, New London, Connecticut, U.S. Cold War geography, right? But when my dad retired, we went toward my mom's home. And so my coming of age begins in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And then we've sort of slowly discovered a group of us that just sort of found debate in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and found our way into the discipline, which is kind of another story. But then when my dad retired, my mom's family is a very large Southern family, and we ended up back in the South, right? In South Carolina, right? And so then ultimately,
where you went to college, right? I think.
Yeah. So I finished my bachelor's degree at the University of South Carolina. I finished my master's degree at Louisiana State, taught in Tennessee, and then went to Illinois to get my PhD. It's an interesting story. Maybe the first thing I do is I say, you know, maybe I hide it a little bit and say I'm a military brat. Second of all, I will admit that to go back to our original conversation, and might be an interesting way to pull it together, but my activity in debate, not so much that I was trying to hide my accent debater, but one of the skills, it's hard to explain in the United States context, but one of the skills that you have to learn to do kind of national circuit high school and college debate at the time I was doing it is that you had to learn how to speak very, very quickly. I mean, like I'm really talking anywhere from 250 to 300 words a minute. And in that process of learning how to speak quickly, you start flattening your voice a little bit. So
Yes, of
I
course.
deregionalize, right? I
Yes.
deregionalize a little bit, right? I don't, I to be frank, I don't feel maybe it's a reminder. I mean, sometimes I felt it, when I'm around, a lot of PhDs from the Ivies. Maybe I feel it a little bit more. But since I'm a state university kid with, a comm studies PhD, right? I don't feel the stereotype too much. Though occasionally, if you will, again, to steal one of your words, I run into Humanities One every once in a while, and there's a certain kind of, prestige elite sort of way of talking and being,
Auteur with an H rather than without an H.
yes.
No,
And
thank you.
I messed that up, right? And I mess stuff like that up all the time, right? But generally speaking, one of the advantages of our discipline is that that we have to write, and so the regionalisms are hidden
No,
there.
it's interesting just for some listeners. For example, in Britain, the way I speak is called RP or received pronunciation, which basically means ethnically unmarked, i.e., white, upper middle class, southeastern. In the United States, the equivalent is what linguists call Ohio English, but which is popularly and rightly known as NBC English. And it's the same. It is what someone from California or New York, from a white middle class background, sounds like.
That's
But
right.
it's ch Ohio English itself is changing because the so-called Southern twang has moved northwards.
No,
So.
and I, when I was in Illinois, I mean, some of my neighbors were from Southern Illinois, and they had much more Southern accents than I did.
And not only, I spent a couple of years recently in New Orleans. And there are African Americans who've never left the South who sound like white guys from the Bronx, sound straight out of not Compton, but Car 54, where are you? And language, accent, and so on are unbelievably complicated in the United States, more complicated than anywhere else I know. But these stereotypes are powerful.
They are.
And if you sound as though you're from the South, it seems to me there's a cultural discount against you in intellectual circles in many other parts of the country, despite all the, as part of the condescension towards the South, frightened of fear of the South, but also in a weird way related to some sort of bizarre respect for the South. Think about the way in which Gone with the Wind for white folks in much of the United States remains an almost sacred text. Anyway, so
No,
I
that's
appreciate your frankness on that very much.
I mean, I'm not, and I part of what you, I mean, I think sometimes what you have to fight back, or maybe this is a new way to put it in a new context, right? Maybe I have become, of a certain class and a certain politics and a certain way of being, in which, 20 years ago, I would have had, I mean, I taught at the University of Texas for a few years. I had no consternation of going to Austin, right? Austin's its own little planet, right? But I had no, there was no part of me that said I should not go back to the University of Texas, right? Or I shouldn't go back south, right? And where, you know, today there are new politics, new relationships where I do think about things in different ways, where in some ways I'm a little more comfortable in my blue enclave here in the Twin Cities because of those histories, even if, you know, some of us spend our time at the conventions talking about, you know, how Hubert Humphrey pushed away the farmer labor side of the DFL, right? But you know, there are the you know, I would have to, I would be remiss if I didn't say that I have become estranged in some ways from what I thought was a kind of reasonable zone of interaction in the South. And I mean that you know, to try to push back against the idea that, you know, all of us that come from the South were Richard Weaver and we wanted to defend the traditions of the South, right? That we, many of us came of age in a different political milieu, and we were very active, and I was very active in a place called the Grassroots Organizing Workshop that did all kinds of multiracial work in terms of Reaganomics and Reagan histories and Reagan foreign policies and all and conservative work in the South. But it those spaces are getting harder and harder. People are moving here, right? They're Minnesota's become, I mean, it's almost 19th century-esque in the ways in which Minnesota's becoming a sanctuary state, especially for trans kids and trans families that are trying to move out of the South because they can't. Life is becoming unlivable. Not so different, perhaps, than the great African American migrations in the early part of the 20th century.
Interesting. These are good points. Sorry, Ron. It looks as though I'm not listening. I am, but the podcat is making huge amounts of noise and disturbance, and I need to give him a little bit of attention. I'm
Absolutely.
sure
Do what
what
you
he's
need.
trying to do. He's one of the apparently 3% of cats that play catch. I've
Cool.
spoken to the vet about this, and it is about
Yeah.
this. I'm astonished that he can wake me up at any hour of the day or night to play
Wow.
catch. And
Yeah.
I love it, but I don't know where this comes from. And anyway, the ball's just gone, pardon the expression, south. But
Yes.
as I say, I appreciate very much your frankness about that and talking about the difficulty of maintaining your links there and of the fact that the upper Midwest and the Northeast and the West Coast have become sanctuaries for oppressed people.
Right.
A last question before I hand things over to you, Prof. Ron, is to ask you a boring question. So you're at the University of Minnesota, you're up for the most distinguished professorial rank possible. And there's a biologist, there's a biochemist, there's an economist, there's a historian on the panel, and they're saying to you, Dr. Green, this is all very well. How do you know any of this? How do you find shit out? I'm helping you out here, Ron. I'm coaching you for the tough questions.
Right.
No, but seriously, it's a query that I often pose for myself, and I don't have a good answer,
Right.
which is why I'm asking you to help me.
Yeah, I you know, and I'll put another twist on it, if you will. I mean, especially in an age of computational methods in which, to use a version from the language of argumentation studies, it's increasingly being referred to as the extractive metaphor of data of argument mining, right?
Document
So
mining. I love it.
argument mining, right? And so we kind of take our notions of, you know, what are good arguments, or what is an argument form, and then we go scrape the Now I understand these were LLMs, right? But we go scrape the internet and say, oh, no, there are five major arguments in this policy dispute. And there you go, right? And in a world in which, I used to read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of court decisions or deliberations of Congress or archival finds inside of church basements or in the catacombs of, religious institutions or in the YWCA or the YMCA. That I have to admit, there are parts of me that's like, yeah, how do I get an algorithm to do some of this work for me? That used to be what I do, right? But I will put it this way, right? And maybe this is at the risk of sounding old-fashioned, right? I am struck by there's a tradition in my own discipline called the history of public address, and the tradition is one in which you look at famous, or not even maybe don't even have to be famous speeches, right? You just look at you look at the popular and public discourse of different periods of U.S. history, and you can expand this, and you can change your genres, and you can do all kind of stuff, right? With
But you
this,
come back to 263 words,
yes,
the
that's right.
Gettysburg Address.
The Gettysburg Address. That's right. And every once in a while, you got to teach. I truly believe I'm getting a little old fashioned now, but I'm telling my students, you do not understand why Trump is using the word silent majority unless you understand that Nixon used that in 1969 to talk about, right, a particular population that he was trying to attach himself to, that, the Wallace changes going on in the US political culture, the coming of the Republican Party to the South.
The
I
Southern
mean,
strategy.
the Southern strategy, the way in which this also spoke to people, to what will be memorialized as Archie Bunker in Queens, right? That this
Right,
was
right.
speaking to them, right? And or even the phrase America First, which, to come back to Minnesota, has a lot of things to do with Charles Lindbergh and the resistances to World War II, right? And so there are these moments in which, maybe there are phrases, if you will, maybe not quite the Foucauldian notion of a statement, but I mean, there are phrases, there are tropes, there are arguments that have a way of surviving periods and get reinterpreted and redefined. And in some ways, I try to say, I try to account for that process. And I don't necessarily think that that's all in, maybe it will be, but I don't think that's all in, or that can't be differentiated by an LLM, right? And it can't be, right, fully respected process of learning, which I also, to come back to, is about, I can just see that we cannot underestimate the need for, as much as I will critique certain forms of reading formations, and as much as I will critique how close reading techniques can become their own mechanisms of subjectification. But there is a, I almost mean this at almost a kind of literacy, right? A slow learning, if you will. Some people refer to it as that, right? Well, read this speech. I mean, I mean, I'm sure people are saying, read this tweet, or read this, right? Read, or X, or whatever, right? Read this novel, of course. But I mean, there are these things that can be read that can provide you with a context by which to understand your life. And I had the fear of trying to sound like a 19th century hermeneutics. I mean, but there's a text, right? And there's a history of interpretation, and there are frameworks by which we come to understand these things.
Understandings. Look, Ron, I hear you, and I think any US person on my imaginary committee would recognize the two things that I taught last week in Spain in translation, the Gettysburg Address and I Have a Dream.
Right.
And to me, at one level, they're self-explanatory, but they also incarnate an extraordinary amount of US history and struggle.
That's right.
I couldn't make sense of them to the students. They were so encrusted with things that you know better than do I, but I also know that are not known to P2 working class and lower middle class Spanish students.
Right.
Who, by the way, don't know about the Spanish Civil War, so why
Right.
should we be surprised? But when I tell them your Civil War never ended, just like the US Civil War never ended, they sort of listen. They sort of listen. And when you think about that century between Lincoln and King, you realize how much and how little changed. And since then, just how grotesque things still are. Well, Prof, I want to conclude by throwing it over to you and asking if there are things you'd like to add about your later research, because we've talked about the ongoing work and the very early work, but perhaps you want to talk about things in the middle or perhaps about something else that takes your fancy.
I was part of I've become I am interested perhaps slowly, but I am interested in the coming of AI and how that is going to affect political discourse. And I have sort of started a slow project on I almost want to. I know I'm going. I've pulled out some of the old stuff on the coming of robocalls in the United States as a particular form of political solicitation, right? We often think about it as marketing too, of course, but I mean, but the coming of the robocall and the particular desire to regulate the robocall and how we tried to find ways to regulate the robocall. And then this 21st version, 21st century version is only going to be, the way in which deep fakes and AI bots and bot farms and all of these will increasingly affect democratic discourses, right? Or the discursive environment in which we are living in, right? And so I have been starting a small, some scholars here. I got involved with some scholars here on campus. We're trying to think through AI and its particular relationship to capitalism in a broad context. But for me, it's more my particular inventions and contributions have been more around what's going to happen to political communication in an age of AI, right? As we got some feels for what that probably looked like, 10 years ago, right? With troll farms and stuff, right? But this is also recognizing that this is all international, right? Global, right? There's going to be new ways in which there's probably efforts at transnational forms of governance around these processes. Obviously, I got, the way in which TikTok became a sort of, and still is kind of a moral panic in the United States about Chinese data collection, right? But it's all within that context. It just seems to me that the coming of the way in which our political discourse is about to be informed by new AI technologies and the transformation of that in light of everything else that we do without saying, like when I say that, I don't mean that that only means the social mediaization or the digitization of political discourse. I mean, I think I'm interested to see, if you will, do AI deep fakes find their way on our television screen during the political campaign coming up, right? Or how and what ways are we going to regulate Right. I guess I mean what I really mean to say is that I am betting that people will make and do image manipulation, right? And then it will go immediately on our screen. Like there'll be very little mediation or very little editorial choice because there's very little editorial control over political advertisement, right? And so I'm both fascinated in a weird like way to use that word, I suspect, but the coming of the AI, the AI political discourse, political consultancy, political communication interface, and to recognize that that's going to go across, it's going to go across spectrums from your telephone to your TV, right, to your social media feeds, to, right. So I think that's probably a big thing where I'm increasingly thinking about, and I'm going to be watching the 2024 election as it's already happening. I'm already seeing it, right? I see deep fake versions of Biden and Trump on social media. I just haven't on TikTok or another form of social media. I haven't necessarily caught it on my TV yet, but I watch a lot of sports, and so it might not have quite made it. Those ads haven't quite made it until the new US football season starts. Then we'll start seeing more of them.
Well, thank you, Prof. Ron. As I said earlier, I learned so much from you from the day we met, and I really appreciate your participating in our discussion today.
I can't tell you how honored I am, Toby, that you asked me to be a part of your podcast. Thank you very much.